Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Speaking Freely. I'm Annette Newell. Here we go, already Thanksgiving week. So, how about having a healthier holiday season with less illness and fewer injuries? So I talked to an expert, Dr. Christian Molstrom. He is Legacy Go Health Urgent Care's medical director, and in this interview, he explains how to care for cooking burns, prevent food poisoning, and avoid COVID-19, flu, RSV, and colds in the coming weeks of gatherings. Well, how can we stay safe with Thanksgiving rapidly approaching, from common food preparation mistakes, practices to navigating another COVID flu cold season? We have Dr. Christian Molstrom. He is with Legacy Go Health Urgent Care. You're the medical director there. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Well, first of all, with Thanksgiving coming, there's lots of things that can go wrong in the kitchen with all that cooking, including burns. If someone gets a cooking burn, what's the best thing to do?
So cooking burns, very common at any time, but everybody's trying to do this difficult turkey. So the first thing you want to do is just run the burn under some cool water, not ice cold. You don't need to put ice on it. That's probably worse than just sort of, you know, room temperature water for a good 10 minutes. That's a long time. People are going to, for a couple minutes, I'll be like, that's enough. I would set a timer, 10 minutes. What you want to do is you need to actually cool down the skin. And that burn goes in a few layers deep. There's different kinds of burns, first, second, and third degree burns. Most of the ones that will happen in the kitchen are going to be first degree burns, but they're still, you know, a few, like maybe a millimeter deep into the skin. And it can take a while to cool that down all the way into the tissues there. It also will help relieve the immediate pain of the burn immensely. After that, my recommendation is to dry it off. You don't want to rub the skin, so patting the skin, and then applying a moisturizing lotion or just Vaseline. Straight up Vaseline is probably the best thing you can put on, a very thin smear. If you have a moisturizing lotion, that's fine. In this case, I always recommend things that don't have scents. So Eucerin, for example, is very good. Nivea is good. Nivea is a little bit thicker and may not feel that good when you're rubbing it on tender skin. But Vaseline is very easy to put on, and there's really nothing in it that will react with the skin. And then I would cover that with some kind of a bandage that's a non-stick bandage. So if you have that sticky ACE wrap is really great. We call that Coban. That's fabulous. Put a gauze on there. And you just want to keep the skin protected so you don't ding it on something. So there are going to be some burns, though, that need beyond that. That's your simple first aid at home. And those probably don't need to go in and see a doctor. There are certain areas where burns, though, can be problems. And those are going to be, so large burns. We usually don't see huge burns from the kitchen, but a burn that's more than, say, two or three sizes of a palm probably should go in and just have a doctor look at that, just to make sure that it is not concerning. All right, you can come into an urgent care. It's probably not something you need to go into the emergency department for, but it's also, I understand people, that's a time-sensitive issue. So wherever you can get in. Also, burns that cover body joints, right? So creases of the skin or joints like on a finger or wrist. Those tend to be more difficult areas of healing because the skin is moving back and forth. Now, for a first degree burn, that's generally not going to be too much of a problem. But like I said, it's probably a good idea to have somebody, if there's an extensive burn over a joint, to just have a doctor look at that to make sure that it doesn't need to have follow-up care. Blisters are another big thing. Blisters, you're not going to find, those aren't going to be apparent right away. Those will form probably within hours or the next day. All right. Blisters are the, and usually means that the, it's a little deeper burn. It's a second degree burn. The blisters you can just leave though. Patients always want to know, should I pop them? Should I not pop them? Just leave them be. The fluid that's inside the blister is sterile, so it doesn't do any harm at all to your skin. When you do pop the blister, though, you do are opening up the skin to a little bit of exposure to bacteria that's just on the skin. But sometimes those blisters are going to rupture and they're going to pop on their own, and that's fine. So just, again, keep the wound clean and covered would be the best thing, all right? Very significant burns, which are unlikely to happen in the kitchen. You literally need to have your hand over a gas flame for a period of time, would produce skin that is charred or thickened. And if you actually have a third degree burn, you're not going to have any sensation. You've actually burned all the nerve endings there, and it's not painful, ironically. Those absolutely will need the hospital because there's specific care that needs to be taken care of, sometimes some surgery, grafting, and whatnot.
Another big issue this time of year is how to prevent food poisoning. So what are your best tips for that?
Yeah. Okay. So food poisoning is a result of bacteria, typically bacteria. Now it can be viruses, but generally it's from bacteria that are on the food. Now the bacteria get on the food. Actually, bacteria is on food all the time. We eat it. It's not a problem. Our gut and our immune system is used to having bacteria around. So, but if there is a certain high density of certain kinds of bacteria, it can make us sick. So Salmonella is one. Clostridium perfringens is another bacteria. The names don't really matter that much. But anytime food is left out that doesn't have preservatives or doesn't have high concentrations of sugar or high concentrations of salt, those are the sort of things that bacteria generally don't grow on. So like, you know, a freshly cooked turkey, stuffing, rice, those are the sort of things. What, you know, bacteria will start growing and populating within a few hours. Now, it takes several hours for there to be a significant amount on the food to make somebody sick. But generally, why risk it? Just it's best just to prevent that. So if you keep your food either very warm or hot or cold, it's going to prevent the growth of the bacteria. We all know that bacteria still grow in the refrigerator if you leave your food there long enough, but it just slows that process down. So keep your food warm. When you're done eating it, you know, it can sit out on the counter for a little while. You know, it's not a big deal. We obviously know that, right? Because we have a meal and it's out on the counter for a couple hours. But you should get it in the refrigerator fairly soon after that. Yeah, one last thing. How does bacteria get on food? People may wonder. Well, I mean, touching it. So, you know, it gets a knife that was set on the counter and then you use the knife or, you know, hands that aren't washed, unwashed hands on the food. That's how the bacteria initially will get on the food. So it's just a great reminder when you're handling food, wash your hands or wear some of those gloves, right? The like the kitchen gloves, those are great too. Hand sanitizer, super important.
Mm-hmm. What about knife safety? How is that important when we're using a lot of knives for cooking and eating and all that? What do we need to do to make sure we don't injure ourselves or others?
I see a ton of knife injuries in my clinics, and they're usually around dinner time. And you know, it's people are never seem to be particularly careless about it. I think that it's a situation most commonly where people are just working too fast, right? So they're trying to cut up vegetables, they're trying to prep. So probably, quite honestly, the best way to prevent any knife injuries is to just make sure you're not rushing. So give yourself a lot of time to prepare your food, go to a leisurely pace where you can concentrate on the knife and the celery that you're chopping up, and you're not distracted with a bunch of conversations from your relatives that have come over and they're yapping at you about everything that's going on. You know, you look up to respond to something and all of a sudden you've cut yourself. So that's, I think, probably the simplest thing there to prevent that. I mean, there are some gloves and things like this too, you know, that people have worn. I've seen them online. I've never actually met anybody that has used. They're like little mesh gloves to help prevent the left hand if you're right hand cutter from getting cut. But I think that's the, you know, focusing on your work, not being distracted. You know, you want to have your knives in a safe spot. Oftentimes there'll be a lot of knives out in a situation like this, and some of them might be near the edge of a counter and it gets knocked off. So I have definitely seen some knife injuries where people have, you know, the knife has dropped down and speared their foot. So just having them in, you know, out of the way so they're not likely to get pushed off is a good tip. I mean, sharp knives are great, but they're also great for cutting fingers as well. But they're wonderful for use on food.
Okay. And of course, a big one, we're going to be gathering in person with relatives. In my family, what we do is we meet outside. We're still in the COVID flu cold, and now RSV season. This year, RSV is really rearing its ugly head. So what is your words of wisdom about as we're making these Thanksgiving gatherings with our families? What do we need to do to try to stay healthy?
I think for most of us, it's going to be somewhat of a regular, kind of a regular Thanksgiving, meaning that, you know, there's always somebody that might be bringing in an upper respiratory virus or flu or something like that. And for most of us, it's probably at this point not a big deal. It might keep you out of work if you get COVID or flu for a few days. But this is also the time when we're gathering with some extended family or friends, and they may have some health conditions. And that's a tough situation. I think that those individuals know who they are. And, you know, for the last 2 years have learned special, you know, things that they need to do to keep safe. So I think that although masks are effective, the whole point of Thanksgiving is a meal and you can't eat with a mask on. So I've been to these gatherings where people come in and they wear the mask and then the masks come off as soon as you start eating. So I don't know if masks are really a helpful thing during a dinner party when you're eating. Eating outside is a great option, but very unlikely to be very comfortable for people. And ventilation, again, you know, this is why people get sick in the winter, is that we wouldn't be inside our cozy houses. So aside from that, the things that you can do, which I think are effective, are just making sure when people come in that they get some hand sanitizer, they clean their hands. If they're working with food, if they're touching other individuals, hugging or whatever, that they're cleaning their hands all the time. Because what common way in which we give an infection to somebody else, it might not necessarily be through coughing or sneezing. Those are obvious, but, you know, we touch our face and stuff. I mean, we all touch our face very frequently and we don't even know about it. So you can have a little bit of a sniffle. It's not so much that the sniffle is going to make somebody sick, but you're using your fingers and you know, you're getting a little bit of virus, and then you know, you go and hug somebody or whatever, or you hand them a glass of wine and the virus has now got on the wine stem. And so they touch it. So hand sanitizers are going to be really easy to do. And I recommend that. So testing as well coming in. I think that if you are sick, you probably should say no thank you, unless you're going to be with a bunch of people who have very strong, you know, a bunch of healthy young people that aren't going to have a problem with getting sick. But I would probably let people know, hey, I've had a cough for a few days. Is everybody comfortable with that? I would recommend staying home if you're going to be around anybody with frail health conditions. So people that are very elderly, really, really young, like newborns, infants, you know, under the age of 6 months, or anybody with this on active kind of medical treatment for autoimmune diseases or cancer. Now, you may not know that, but I mean, those people will know, obviously, if they have those conditions. And they will appreciate knowing if somebody's saying they're reporting that they're sick. So in terms of testing before coming in, there's a couple ways to do this. So you can go into a medical center and get tested. The advantage of that is that a lot of places, my clinic, for example, will have a single swab. We can test for all of those flu A and flu B, COVID and RSV all in one swab. So that is handy, and it's a PCR test, and that takes about 45 minutes. Other urgent care clinics and primary care clinics may have a similar thing. It might be a send out, or they may have one where they could just do a COVID test or just a flu test. But I think definitely the COVID is the big one you want to probably test for to make sure that your cough isn't COVID. If you test at home, the antigen tests, those are the home tests. You need to do two of those, really. So you kind of have to plan ahead of time, and they should be at least 24 hours apart, if even better if they're 48 hours apart. And the CDC's recommendation is 48 hours apart. So what does that mean? So Let's say I'm feeling a little under the weather on Sunday. So maybe on Monday I get a test. I do at home test and it's negative. That's great. But I really need to do a second one. And so either Tuesday or Wednesday before Thanksgiving, I do another one. And if that one's also negative, you know, I can be pretty reassured that I don't have COVID. Why two tests? And it's like I would liken it to this. So the tests themselves, the antigen at-home tests are not, they're very accurate when they're positive. Okay. So if that makes sense, or like when the little line comes up, there's very few conditions that are going to make that line light up other than COVID. Now, but the tests can miss the COVID virus quite often. But if you do the tests back to back and you do two or three of them, just by probability, if multiple ones are keep saying negative, it's unlikely that they keep missing a disease. So that's good. RSV is not really a big deal for adults. For adults, it's going to make people sick. It's going to feel like an upper respiratory infection. RSV can be a problem for young children, though. So that's something to keep in mind, that adults can get RSV, they can give it, but it's not the sort of thing that I think that should keep you home.
Well, moving past Thanksgiving for the rest of the holiday season, what are some of your best tips to keep people healthy and safe for yourself and your family?
So I think that going just into the holidays, keeping healthy, I would strongly consider wearing a mask indoor spaces where there's going to be high concentrations of people and you're not eating and drinking, right? I mean, I think that it's reasonable to go to the restaurant and do that. That's, you know, people need to be people and enjoy life and have those social connections. And those are super valuable, as well as staying, you know, staying healthy. But there are times when being in closed spaces with large numbers of people, wearing a mask is important. So travel is a big one that people ask about. These days, not that many people are wearing masks in the airplane or in the airport, probably 10%. You know, from what I can tell, I've traveled recently. I think that my personal feeling is that the cabins are fairly safe. They have very good air filtration and airflow. And we just did not see a lot of COVID outbreaks associated with being inside the cabin. Like we would have, I mean, I think that like we just didn't see a lot of crew members get sick. So from work. So I think that, you know, wearing a mask inside the cabin, probably a crowded flight would be great, especially if you're somebody with a frail medical condition, or if you're sitting next to somebody who seems they might be sick. I'd recommend that. The airports themselves are a little different because the ventilation in an airport is altogether, you don't know. And I think that's a little bit more of a wild west when you get into the airport. So wearing a mask in and out of the airport is, I would recommend, again, every time you have a chance to get a pump of sanitizer, do that. Fortunately, there's still a lot of those stations around in public areas and airports. You kind of have to look for them. You have to be on the lookout for them, but they're there. And I think that, we haven't touched on driving, right? I mean, road accidents are common. We all hear about them on the radio during the holidays like Christmas and Thanksgiving. From a medical standpoint, as a physician, I don't have a lot to say about that because fortunately the car industry and the government have put in all these really great safety standards. The one thing though that as an individual, people need to be very careful of, again, two things I would say: don't drink and drive, which isn't new advice, but it's a situation where both are mixing and so be very mindful of that. And also, again, give yourself plenty of time planning. I think that, you know, being late to get to Thanksgiving, you know, you're rushing, you're driving, that's a common cause of traffic accidents is just rushing on the road.
And another thing, you probably want to try to limit your alcohol intake for the holidays. What would your advice be to people about that specifically?
Well, everybody have different tolerances for alcohol. Body weight is generally a fairly reliable one. So larger individuals can drink more, but there's also how much you drink, and we actually are born with different concentrations of alcohol metabolizing enzymes. I think we probably all know some people who are like, they never seem to get intoxicated. And then we also have friends that are lightweights and drink half a beer and they're tipsy. So everybody kind of knows their limit. But generally speaking, a good rule of thumb is a portion of alcohol for an adult every hour is going to generally keep you, I think, you know, you enjoy the, you know, the mild effects of the alcohol and also the culinary, the gastronomical pleasures as well, without being really intoxicated. Again, that might not be for everybody, a smaller person or somebody that's just not used to drinking. So I think pacing yourself out. So if you're going to be, you know, at a dinner that's going over for a long period of time, just not drinking a lot quickly. The other thing that helps is drinking a similar portion of water in between your drinks. So if you have a beer, don't go in and reach for another beer in the fridge. That's the time to say, oh, I'm going to have a soda now or a glass of water. And then when you're done with that, maybe have a second beer. That also kind of forces you to pace out. It also is hydrating. Alcohol is dehydrating. And this kind of all the bad stuff that we associate with alcohol, over intoxication, headaches, and blah, 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 oftentimes can be ameliorated with just being hydrated, overhydrated. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you spending all this time with me and going over these great tips. Is there anything else I haven't asked you about you'd like to add?
Yeah, I didn't touch on vaccines.
Sure.
So another important, I should say, safety prevention measure for the holidays is our vaccines. So we've got flu vaccines and COVID vaccines. They are approved for 6 months and up. And although the vaccines are not 100, in both cases, are not 100% effective, and I'm using air quotes here, although nobody can hear that, they do reduce your risk of getting really sick. And so if you've got a flu vaccine, you might still get the flu, but you're not gonna feel nearly as bad as if you had not had the flu vaccine. That's definitely true for COVID. The main benefit for the COVID vaccines is not so much from keeping people from getting sick, it's keeping people from getting really sick and being in the hospital. And there is some evidence that it reduces how much you transmit to somebody. So if you have a COVID vaccine and you get COVID, you're going to recover faster and you're less likely to just produce viral particles that you can spread to other people, right? So there's definitely a public health benefit there with just being a kind of a good social citizen and being vaccinated. And I think that probably at this point, most of us have had COVID, whether or not we know it or not. And if we haven't, you're probably going to get it at some point because it's just hard to avoid. And despite your best measures and despite being vaccinated, but if you can reduce the chance of you getting somebody else sick, that's great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate all your help today and try to keep us safe and healthy for the holidays.
Thank you, Annette. It's been a pleasure being on your show.
And that was Dr. Christian Mollstrom, the medical director of Legacy Go Health Urgent Care. And this week, more election results rolled in. Oregon's about to have quite a few firsts as a result. Its first out female lesbian governor, as well as the first two Latino members of Congress representing the state. I asked several experts for their reactions to the midterm results. First, here's Professor Susan Shaw, who studies gender and sexuality for Oregon State University.
Despite my enthusiasm of seeing lesbian governors elected, I'm not sure representation across gender, race, sexuality matters in the same way anymore in such a divided political environment. I'm thinking about Herschel Walker in Georgia, where essentially people have said, you know, we don't really care what he's done, what he says, as long as he's going to vote our way, we're going to vote for him. And so now we see him going into that runoff with Raphael Warnock. And so I think in some ways at this moment, it's are you a Republican or a Democrat? And that's all we need to know. And we're much less concerned about anything else about you. And so I think the notions of representation are really shifting in some ways in this climate.
That was OSU Professor Susan Shaw. For more perspective, here's Catherine Bosendahl, director of OSU's School of Public Policy. She's a political sociologist.
I've been thinking about some of the choices that the political parties have been making in terms of who to support for candidates, because you see maybe some effort to wash out the effect of, say, gender or race by putting two candidates of the same gender, like all women. So I know Chavez de Remer, her opponent was also a woman, right? And so we had three women running for governor. And they present different, in terms of the gubernatorial race, different kind of flavors of femininity and gender. And because the Democratic Party typically kind of owns the issues that are associated more so with people and soft issues, and women tend to get more credit for that. Whereas the Republican Party, I mean, historically, even if we go back to work done in the late 80s, you know, didn't really allow women to run as women. You know, you were expected to downplay that wasn't an important part of who you were as a candidate. And so, you know, to see Drazen kind of have to walk that line was really interesting. And I haven't really had a chance to make sense of it yet.
And that was political sociologist Catherine Bozendahl, the director of Oregon State University's School of Public Policy. I also asked another expert, Dr. Chris Nichols, a historian and political author with The Ohio State University, for his midterm results reaction. What was your big aha moment of the election? What was the moment you were like, oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe that just happened.
I think the thing that stood out to me was the people, including myself, who were looking at it closely. The thing that we all expected was that this would not be decided on election day. And that was absolutely correct. That anyone who prematurely was declaring victory for one party or the other, or in a whole host of specific campaigns, they were wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So judiciously withholding a full assessment seemed like the responsible thing to do. And the journalists and pundits who did not do that, and politicians, they were the ones who got burned. So that, I mean, that's one bigger takeaway. I think we should, for the near term, for maybe the next several election cycles, we should all pause on premature judgments, and even on polling, and even on, you know, good estimates of what districts are going to, how they'll turn out. As you look at how razor thin these margins are, thousands of votes, hundreds of votes, and you and I have talked about this several times, you know, you just can't predict that number. It's too statistically small. It's too modest. You know, a district leans R or D, but that does not help you when you're looking at, did you have quite enough turnout of a particular group? Okay, so big picture, thinking about turnout, we had that youth vote that we were thinking about. We had the younger generation came out and voted. I still am looking for all the statistics and data analysis, but it looks like this was a record midterm for people in the youngest age demographic of voters, and that they voted, it looks like, roughly 2/3 of them Democratic. Seems also important in thinking about the future of what the American electorate looks like, the kinds of issues they care about, why they came out. Some people have, I think, prematurely were interested in the question of student debt relief and saying that that was central to this. And while I think that's undoubtedly part of it, when you look at polling of younger Americans, the Dobbs decision and women's reproductive rights stands out to me as one of the things that was incredibly important, but also, and not insignificantly, questions of democracy, that they actually really seemed to care about free and fair elections and weren't persuaded by election deniers, but rather wanted to reject election deniers. I think that in the way I think about why they came out and voted as they did, that's kind of how I parse that. So as a, I don't know if it counts as an aha moment, but the fact that so many young voters did come out and they seem to have been the margin of difference in this not being a red wave or even a red ripple, but rather a pretty modest set of gains that barely gets the House to Republicans, and in a number of governorships and a number of state legislatures actually turn things blue. That seems really important to me. And it certainly seems, looking to the future, like exactly what we need to be thinking about when we think about the next 5 to 10 years.
And that was Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols, the author and editor of several books about American politics and history. Thanks so much to Professors Nichols, Bozendahl, and Shaw, as well as Dr. Molstrom, for offering your expertise to the show. You're listening to Speaking Freely with Annette Newell. Thanks for tuning in. If you have an idea for what you'd like to hear about on the show, send me an email to annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. One more time, that's annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. Be sure to join us again next week and check out our Speaking Freely podcast on KXL.com.